Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. My guest today is Claudia Isaac. She's an associate professor in the School of Architecture and Planning at the University of New Mexico. Professor Isaac earned a bachelor's degree in psychology at Bryn Mawr College, a master's degree in public affairs and planning at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, and a PhD in urban and regional planning at UCLA. Her work has focused on community-engaged scholarship and practice in the areas of affordable housing, neighborhood planning and land use, community economic development, and metropolitan redevelopment. And among the organizations with whom she has worked are New Mexico Main Street, the Southeast Heights Health Coalition, Enlace Comunitario, and the American Friends Service Committee. Welcome, Professor Isaac.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you recently received the second annual Community Engaged Research Lectureship Award. It's one of the highest awards bestowed by UNM. What is community engaged research and how does it differ from other academic research?
It's a subset of academic research. I think that's an important thing to consider. Many people consider community engaged scholarship as somehow not research, and it is research. It's about creating new knowledge. It's about finding ways to advance our understanding of the larger universe and world. The difference is that community engaged research is based in communities. It's driven by applied real community needs, and it engages partners. In fact, it asks for invitations from community partners to be members of the research team. It can involve a large number of methodologies. In fact, all of the methodologies that quote-unquote traditional research utilize.
So it's rigorous.
It's rigorous, mm-hmm. Yes. But it's community-driven. And very often, it's engaged in order to solve a community problem. And so its purpose, although it is knowledge creation, is to inform policy, to inform political action, redevelopment action on the ground at a very small scale. The intent is to reach as wide an audience as possible. Quality traditional research looks for international and national acknowledgement and engagement so that it gets out there, other people respond, and that generates the engine of new research. In community engaged research, that generation and conversation and dialogue happens at a much smaller scale because it's about problem solving at a smaller scale.
At your recent lecture, you said we must avoid the cult of expertise and decentered research requires humility. Can you talk about that? Why would that be a difficult shift for some people?
I've often said that the currency of the university, particularly a research university, is prestige. That you rise yourself above others in your field. Community-engaged research doesn't work very well that way. It requires that kind of horizontal dialogue and for researchers to understand that what we have to for academic researchers, everybody in this process is a researcher and a scholar, but for academic researchers to understand that they are contributing something in a horizontal way that's no more or less valuable than what the community researchers, the professional researchers, the policymakers, whoever is engaged in this research team have to contribute. We have a tendency in the academy, even those of us committed to community research, to think of, yes, we want to hear from the community, but we have a kind of romantic view of what that is, that somehow it's, because it's heartfelt, it's somehow not quite so analytical. And I have not found that to be at all true. That kind of humility requires a retraining of the academic brain that has been carefully trained to seek that kind of eminence and to set oneself above and apart from others in the field. This has been traditionally a fairly elite practice, and this is explicitly trying to turn that on its head and create not just a democratized process, but a process that looks at all kinds of evidence and all sources of evidence and values all of those sources of evidence and analytical capacity equally.
So in this process, some of the projects you've worked on, what is the role of the academic and what's the role of the community?
Well, my students hate my standard answer to these kinds of questions because it depends. In most of the work that I do, I'm invited to participate because I have a particular set of planning, scholarly planning skills. Each discipline is going to have a different set of skills to contribute. Obviously, nobody is going to invite me to do a riparian restoration. I would have nothing to contribute to that except maybe facilitating some meetings about it. So I know about community economic development, its history, its practice, the methodologies for analyzing economic conditions and for designing economic policies. I understand how different sectors of the economy, housing or commercial development or other kinds of development, can either enhance or undermine the ability of a community to capture and utilize its own resources. And I know something about organization development that has proven helpful to many organizations. And so they invite me, and I'm an evaluator. I'm a participatory and empowerment evaluator. So organization.
What does that mean? Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah, explain.
Empowerment evaluation is a term that, and the idea here was that evaluation had been seen as a practice of external people hired by funders to determine whether or not to continue funding projects. That puts staff in an organization in an extremely uncomfortable position. Empowerment evaluation argues that you really want to create a learning organization, and that it's in the interest not only of funders, but of organizations and of the society at large, for organizational staff to be able to think collectively about what's working, what's not working, where their theory of change, the idea that this activity will bring this kind of outcome, works or fails. And so it shifts the attention back on empowering staff and their constituents to learn about their activities and make corrections in their programming accordingly. Communities and mostly organizations and communities have asked me to contribute that.
At your lecture, you talked about the White City. It was created at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. So what was the idea behind that? Why was it so important later on in terms of planning in this country?
The Chicago World's Fair, for if you read just about any history of the planning profession, the official beginning of the profession in the United States was at the Chicago World's Fair, when architects began to look at beyond the building scale specifically to organize a disorganized city. And if you look at cities in the 1890s, they were kind of a mess. High rates of disease vectors and poor, no codes, no building codes, and so poor construction, crowding. There are famous pictures of intersections that have no stoplights or traffic cops, and so they're in all four directions, this complete gridlock. So we know these architects wanted to develop an ordered city. The term the White City did come from Daniel Burnham and the designers of the Chicago World's Fair. It was about the neoclassical design of those buildings, which features white plaster. But they were also explicitly about civilizing the city. And one of the things that those designers didn't talk about, but other activists, particularly African-American and feminist activists at the time, was that what was seen as disorganized about the city were large numbers of immigrants and former slaves moving into cities and disrupting the white city, the metaphorical white city. So there was conversation about it. And I didn't do this original research. This is John Rydell's research. And so while most planners, if you say the White City, they'll say, oh, yeah, those are the neoclassical buildings in the Chicago World's Fair. I think that it's a better title for the kind of planning that emerged at the turn of the last century to order American cities that tend to focus on the physical planning, the design aspects, but there also was a very strong social agenda. And it was about assimilation and civilization. Hmm. Civilization in the worst sense of that word, the most imperial sense of that word. So it wasn't until the New Deal that we really began to see the profession itself. There's always been resistance to this idea, but that was when we began to see the profession itself rethink those foundational principles.
So how did that impact planning in cities throughout the 20th century and even into today? And like, who's left out of that equation?
It's not so much that people are left out. It's that their agency is left out. Mm. The object of the white city, and again, I'm using this term in a way that Burnham didn't, but the object of the white city is to bring all of these newcomers into this utopian order. So you can be an immigrant, and we're going to let you learn how to be a good worker in the factories. You can be African-American, but we're going to teach you how to not be African-American. It was very much based in this idea of, well, American exceptionalism and the idea of an American identity and a complete lack of understanding that that American identity as defined was essentially a white and European Eurocentric identity.
So how do you see your work in community engaged research perhaps as an answer to that?
Well, not just my work, it's mm-hmm. all of the work that people have done since Ida B. Wells and Frederick Douglass, who have said, nope, that's really not what we want our cities to be. And of course, all of this completely left out rural places, indigenous places. They were all seen as places where cities would eventually overtake. They would all be part of this white
utopia. Whitetopia, yeah.
And so there has always been what Hooper has called the oppositional movement or the oppositional trend in planning. I mean, she traces it back to the Paris Commune. I mean, we can go back pretty far.
Yeah.
The idea here is that since the 1960s, there's been an increasing recognition on the part of the profession itself that these activities, what Leonie Sandercock calls insurgent planning historiographies, are not outside of planning, but really are part of the planning endeavor. And so the work that the trend in planning that I choose to locate myself in has a long history. It allows me to look at political relationships within communities and sites of oppression and silencing of voices and unequal allocation of resources and all of these things in a way to increase empowerment evaluation, increase the capacity of communities for self-determination. In this movement in the 60s was also very important because it decentered. That's where the decentering comes. There's now a really robust group of professional and academic planners who acknowledge that planning happens often at its best on the ground, and it confronts issues of social inequality and social injustice in ways that centralized planning simply can't.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm speaking with Associate Professor Claudia Isaac with the School of Architecture and Planning. She recently received the Community Engaged Research Lectureship Award. You have worked with a variety of community groups here around economic development and agriculture and housing. Could you talk about maybe one or two you're really proud of?
The food systems work I find particularly interesting right now because there is such a global foodie movement mm-hmm. that has tended to, again, just as other movements in planning have, to assume that someone with an education, somebody who has this bright idea, somehow it came from nowhere, when in fact there's this long agrarian history, largely in communities that have been disinvested, who are themselves working to challenge the industrial food system and decolonize that food system to recapture, restore their own traditions and create a livelihood and be sustainable and environmentally sustainable and be socially just. I think that the projects that really appeal to me, I think the Workforce Housing Trust Fund work. We did focus groups with neighborhood association members, with members of the building community and real estate, members of unions and employers, to try to understand what people's interests and concerns were about affordable housing. And we put together a PowerPoint presentation that is still on YouTube to explain what the data was, what the actual affordable housing gap was, what workforce housing is, so that people could make a reasoned decision about whether or not to vote for general obligation bonds for workforce housing. The GO bond passed, And the Affordable Housing Coalition every 2 years has engaged in the same kind of research-based, in this case, advocacy for maintaining the Workforce Housing Fund at its highest possible funding. And challenging some other interpretations of how you do poverty alleviation in a city with our own research-based analysis.
I know they've built several developments.
It has increased the ability of both private and public developers to produce affordable housing in Albuquerque.
We hear about lip service and or legitimate efforts towards community engagement around big projects. And yet, does it always happen? Where are the gaps that you see? I mean, I'll bring up the most obvious one right now. People are very upset. Not everyone, but a lot of people are very upset about the rapid transit project. Even though there were many community meetings, people felt like they weren't listened to.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a real disconnect, no matter what you think about the project.
There's a wonderful article by Sherry Arnstein called The Ladder of Citizen Participation. It's a golden oldie. She wrote it in the late 1960s, I think. And she was writing about the Federal Community Action Program. And she was asking exactly that question. Why was it that with such a large federal impetus to increase public involvement in redevelopment kinds of projects, people were still so angry with the redevelopers? And the ladder is wonderful. She has at the bottom of the ladder is therapy and manipulation, that in many cases, the public involvement was designed to mislead people, to provide a place to rant, right? You could come in, you could shake your fists, you could say, I'm really angry, and then you'd get it out of your system and go away. Or manipulation, to pretend that people were being listened to, but in fact were not being listened to. The middle level were levels of tokenism. Consultation when, you know, if you're one community representative in a team of, you know, 25 professionals, your voice is there, but it doesn't really have weight. You're a token in that process. Consultation that comes too late in the process so that there's not really room for readjustment of the plan. Placation of giving a few goodies, but then really not changing the fundamental plan. And then the top rungs of the ladder are citizen power. And I actually prefer to call it resident power because we know that not everybody in the city is a citizen. And those involve delegation, it involves negotiation, and it can involve devolvement of the actual decision-making to community groups. The Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative is a great example.
What's that?
The Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative has been around in Boston for decades. There was a lot of illegal dumping in vacant lots that was not being policed by the city. The city's Boston Redevelopment Organization had plans for the redevelopment of Dudley Street that did not involve community input and was likely to involve a lot of displacement, including demolition of housing. So Dudley Street neighbors, with some participation from MIT, got together to petition the city of Boston to get the power of eminent domain, that is, the ability to condemn properties. That is unheard of for a non-governmental agency to have that power. And it took a great deal of political sophistication on the part of the Dudley Street Initiative to do that. With that power, they were able to enforce city dumping rules to and the absentee landlords that were allowing
it to
happen.
And these are community members?
Yeah.
Wow, interesting.
It's fascinating, really fascinating.
Yeah. You know, you kept saying consultation, and all I could think of was like, and we heard that a lot in the North Dakota Access Pipeline protests.
Yes.
And this dispute over what constitutes consultation. So these issues, even after all these years, are not going away. Do you think the work that you and your other fellow community engaged scholars are doing can address this?
Cautiously, yes. I don't want to diminish the continued power of those with resources and means and political power to overrun a community process or ignore a community process. That happens all the time. It continues to happen. But I do think that we have enough success stories The danger is to get so overwhelmed by the power of the powerful that we throw up our hands and give up. That constant pushback is an essential part of, and aside from being an essential responsibility of human beings, as a planner, I think that's kind of what we all have to be doing. Yeah, sometimes our successes are partial and temporary, and we have to come back and fight those fights over again. But I still think that those efforts are worth it and that there is success in many really substantial and important ways.
Do you think there's growing support in academia for this kind of research that you're doing versus success being rated as publishing in a high-end academic journal, highly respected academic journal? I mean, do you see shifts happening?
I do see shifts happening. I think that they are uneven and slow. Mm-hmm. I'm proud of UNM for engaging at the level of the presidency and vice presidency with these kinds of issues. I respect that there are some disciplines and some units on campus that simply are not on board. And I will reach out to my colleagues in those departments that want to do community engaged work to see if we can find ways for them to do it without damaging their careers. But I also see a number of really important initiatives and people who have been around for a long time. The Community Engagement Center, run by Kieran Kitara here on campus, in the vice president's office and the provost's office, there is a community engagement enterprise. Monica Kowal has been key in advancing that. Virginia Scharf has been key in advancing that. On North Campus, the Center for Community-Based Participatory Research have for years been doing really wonderful work under the guidance of Nina Wallerstein.
So that's creating a culture where this is
honored, validating a culture that was already there, that had started with individual researchers or individual units on campus beginning to have a network. And there's a national movement as well to valorize this kind of work. University of Michigan, Cornell University have major centers for community engaged scholarship.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah,
that's
I'm happy.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, Claudia Isaac, thank you so much for talking to us.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you for inviting me to visit.
That was Claudia Isaac. She's an associate professor in the School of Architecture and Planning at the University of New Mexico. She recently received the second annual Community Engaged Research Lectureship Award. Now we turn to our monthly conversation with the staff of the Daily Lobo student newspaper. And I'm joined this month by news editor Celia Rainey and managing editor Jonathan Baca. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, a lot has happened since we last talked. There's finally a budget for higher education, and Athletics Director Paul Krebs is retiring while investigations into finances are ongoing by the state auditor and the attorney general. Jonathan, how is the Lobo staff following these, and what do you want to see in terms of continuing coverage?
So we have a Board of Regents meeting this week, and they're discussing the budget, so we're going to be covering that, and we're going to be looking into the budget and kind of dissecting it and figuring out, you know, where the university stands and where we're going to be going forward.
And Celia, I know this week we're marking the one-year anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. It was one of the worst mass shootings in U.S. history. You did a story on a vigil here locally. What was the mood like when you went, and how are students in the LGBTQ community feeling?
I was expecting it to be sad. I thought I would see a lot more tears, and there were people who were pretty emotional. But overall, I think people were really hopeful. People really just wanted to promote a safe space for everyone to accept what had happened and then work towards moving forward. I talked to someone who works at the LGBTQ Center on campus, and she said she really is hopeful that young people are starting to make a difference, because now it's not as much of a shock when people come out. And I think people are looking towards the younger generation to really step up and take over what others have already been fighting for.
We just put out our LGBTQ issue, and in it we have a list of resources in Albuquerque and on campus.
Since we last talked last month, we've also heard that there's going to be a cut to how much students can get covered for tuition under the lottery scholarship. What impact do you think that's having?
It's definitely going to have a huge impact on students, because got cut by 30%. So it's, I think it was around another $1,000 that students have to pay next year for tuition. And if you don't have scholarships on top of the lottery, then that is most likely coming out of pocket for students, which is difficult.
It's definitely a troubling trend that we've been seeing for the last few years, is that the lottery scholarship is just getting slowly whittled away. So we definitely want to keep an eye on that. And hopefully the student government is going to be fighting pretty hard to get some of that reinstated this year.
As happens in student newspapers, you're bringing in new staff, you're sort of revamping. Talk a little bit about that. You're going to have people assigned to various beats. What will that look like?
So we have basically almost a whole new team in the newsroom. We have a new editor-in-chief. We have a new news editor. We have a new
Celia.
That would be Celia. We have a new culture editor and a photo editor. You know, we definitely want to increase news coverage, and we're trying to do that with new beats.
We definitely want to have someone always covering what's going on at ASUNM, the student government, because that is one of the biggest impacts to students. We want someone on Board of Regents, so we always know what's going on there, so we have someone at every meeting. We have someone interested in doing mental health, so whenever something new comes up there, the Health Sciences Center, because they're always coming up with new programs and new research, and I think we need to write more about that. We want to do something about campus safety, because I think that's an issue too lately. Students don't feel they can rely on UNMPD, so just kind of following that and how that is going to unfold.
Will you guys try to also focus on things that might be off campus that are having an effect on students and on the campus?
Yeah. We talked about doing a construction beat that would be on and off campus. Of course, that would include art construction, which is supposed to be done in August, but we'll see how that all goes. I think campus safety could probably go off campus too, because UNMPD goes off campus. So
I think also we would definitely like to look more at city and state politics. You know, we got a mayor's race coming up. We're definitely going to be...
Oh, yeah, you've got a young graduate running for mayor.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Gus Pedrotti.
Yeah, so we actually have... One of our reporters is interested in covering the mayor race. Anything going on the legislative level, state, or national even, because a lot of that will still affect us in some way. Those are things that I always encourage people to write about. And I want our writers to do more in-depth stuff, in-depth stories, and really develop a relationship with not just UNM, but the whole community.
Well, great. I want to thank news editor Celia Rainey and managing editor Jonathan Baca from the Daily Lobo. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
This has been University Showcase. Thanks to my guests this month, Associate Professor Claudia Isaac and Jonathan Baca and Celia Rainey with the Daily Lobo. Find this and all our episodes at kunm.org. I'm Megan Kamrick, and thanks for listening to University Showcase.